Welcome to KMEW. I'm Eileen LeBlanc. I'm the news director here, and this is a special broadcast that we're calling Crossing the Cedar Fence, discussing abortion on the anniversary of George Tiller's death. The Cedar Fence separates two women's clinics here. One is Southwind Women's Center, which provides abortion services, and the other is Choices Medical Clinic, which provides alternatives to abortions. We're here to mark the anniversary of Dr. Tiller's death. He was an abortion provider here in Wichita, and he drew national attention because he did perform late-term abortions. Julie Burkhart worked with Dr. Tiller, and she opened her clinic here a year ago, last April, and it's in the same building where Dr. Tiller's clinic was on Kellogg Street. Choices Medical Clinic, which is across the Cedar Fence from Julie's clinic, opened in 1999. So I wanted to welcome our guest, Julie Burkhart. She's the executive director of Southwind Women's Center, and Dr. Scott Stringfield, the medical director of Choices Medical Clinic and Via Christi Family Medicine Residency Program. Julie, welcome to KMUW, and thank you very much for being here. And I'd like to start with a quick question to the both of you. Why did you decide to come and speak about the issues of abortion tonight?
Well, thank you, Eileen, for having me this evening, and it's nice to see you, Scott. I really wanted to be able to take this opportunity to honor the work that Dr. Tiller did and the work that he was so committed to and so passionate about, and to also be able to talk about the matter of reproduction and how deeply personal it is to women who are pregnant, how it's deeply personal and a very intimate decision when it comes to the matter of pregnancy.
Okay. And Scott, why did you decide to come on the program tonight?
Well, I think, first off, I'd say thank you to your station and to you, Eileen. We've had a chance to talk a little bit. And I think for me, the opportunity to visit with Julie a few months ago when we had a kind of a forum really opened my eyes to the possibilities that we could actually have dialogue, have openness, mm-hmm. have teachability, an opportunity to learn, and a chance to influence.
Okay. So thank you both again. We are going to now listen to a documentary that talks about the anniversary of Dr. Tiller's death and a little bit about the history of the abortion debate in Wichita, and then we'll return to the studio. You can email your questions into us at special@kmuw.org. A lot of people were affected by the events of the Summer of Mercy and certainly by Dr. Tiller's death. So we're going to listen to a little bit of that history now.
So that morning in particular, my daughter was celebrating, we were having a reception at the house for her high school graduation. And I drove by and saw traffic and emergency traffic and had no idea. But I had that haunted feeling because I knew who was here. And went home and flipped on a radio. And shortly after that, in the hour leading up to my daughter's reception, I'm hearing these reports. And I remember spending that afternoon, which should have been a joyous day for my daughter and the family, just absolutely undone by the inhumanity of what had happened here. And I hope that people remember it.
The Reformation Lutheran Church is over on 13th Street. My house is about a mile, 1.2 miles from there. So when the police called and told me that we had had a shooting and there was a death, I said, what's the location? And she said, Reformation Lutheran. And I was like, okay. And she said, they shot Dr. Tiller. And I had on shorts and a t-shirt. I threw on my flip-flops, which I normally wouldn't go out like that, and I arrived at the church before the police did, because my house was so close. And so I sat with Jeannie Tiller and her daughter, and with Dr. Tiller's body right there.
I was the only person that saw the gun come up to George's head and being shot. There's other people in the area, but I don't think anybody else saw the actual shooting itself. You know, and sometimes I wish I was one of those other people, because you know, that night I went to bed. I'm not an early morning riser. I finally got to sleep probably around midnight. At 6 o'clock in the morning, I sat up straight in bed and was wide awake. 3 hours later, I was out mowing my yard. I was bawling the entire time.
It was Sunday, May 31st, 2009. Dr. George Tiller was shot in the head and killed. Dr. Tiller was well known for his abortion services, and he was one of the very few doctors in the United States who performed late-term abortions, what he called post-viability. Dr. Tiller was an usher that day, along with Gary Heppner. They were in the narthex, or outer gathering area, of the Reformation Lutheran Church in Wichita. The two had finished their duties at the beginning of the service and had gone out to get a donut.
I just looked. I seen a figure coming out of my peripheral vision. I looked over like that. The gun was up to George's head like I'm pointing my finger at you now. The gun goes off. I go, is that a real gun? Because It just seemed like time just kind of froze, you know, and I'm just standing there going, is that a real gun? And then George fell, and I said, oh, my God, you know, in my head, you know. And then he took off, and I took off after him. I'm like, you're not getting out of here.
Central County 911.
Hey, somebody just came in and shot him in our church.
Somebody shot someone?
Yes, Dr. Tiller. Dr. George Tiller was just shot.
Someone went into the church sanctuary and got Mrs. Tiller, who was singing in the choir. But for most, the service continued. They didn't know. Later that evening, after identifying the man who committed the crime at the police station, Gary Heppner found a donut in his pocket. The man who shot Dr. George Tiller had been at the church before. He had planned to kill him, and it was hard to get to Tiller at his clinic, which had turned into almost a fortress. Tiller's clinic had been the target of anti-abortion protests for many years. It was bombed in 1986. In 1993, Tiller was shot in both arms. But in 1991, a massive effort organized by the Pro-Life Action Network and Operation Rescue descended on the city, where there were three clinics that provided abortion services in Wichita at the time. But the epicenter for the protesters was at Tiller's clinic on Kellogg. Thousands came, and hundreds of locals joined them, including many pastors.
That pastors, priests, clergy are here. We are here peaceful in the heart of Jesus Christ. Hundreds of people of Wichita, family people, caring people, people who love this city, are here praying that no killing goes on here.
They held signs and chanted. They blocked the cars which were trying to get into the clinics. They laid on the streets and in front of the cars, and they pleaded with women who were trying to get in. The Summer of Mercy was 18 years after Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that made abortion legal in the U.S. The protests lasted 6 weeks. 2,600 people were arrested, some multiple times. Former District Attorney Nola Fulston.
And the people were being arrested, brought into the gymnasium. They went right through the revolving door and back out, and it was nonsensical because they were consistently claiming their civil disobedience was okay. And it had been in our history with the civil rights movement, but it nevertheless was disobedience to the law.
I can't recall anything even approaching the divisions that was caused by this subject.
Former Wichita Mayor Bob Knight.
And I was expected to be impartial in the way the city operated. Even within the structure of the city, you know, you had deeply divided opinions. We had them on the city council. You know, you had people that life had shaped them in very distinct and different ways. It was a perfect picture of a community pulling apart.
This is a report by Bryce Madison, Channel 12 Eyewitness News.
Matters heated up here about 3 hours ago. As we are told, a woman came here for services at the Wichita Planning Clinic, and she was following horses through when a little riot evolved here out on the streets. Joining me now is Police Captain Norman Williams. Captain, tell me, what exactly did happen? Was there force used by police?
Apparently what happened was, as the officer was attempting to escort the lady in, some of the protesters proceeded to convene on their horses, and that in turn sparked the officers to react from the standpoint of assisting the officers that were on top of the horses. At 3 o'clock, a patient did come here, wished to go inside, and she met some resistance. Prior to that, the officers were moving through the crowd with the horses, advising them that the horses are coming through, the horses are coming through. That way they could create an avenue for this lady to safely get her to the necessary medical that she was seeking.
Okay, thank you very much, Captain Williams. Again, 15 people arrested. Now, the pro-lifers are saying that no notice of the horses coming through was given. Joining me now is Mr. Randall Terry, the founder of Operation Rescue. Do you believe that excessive force was used?
Definitely. Fortunately, it didn't last that long, but there were over 10 people who were sprayed in the face with mace. One woman has told me that she was kicked in the ribs by a police officer, and those horses waded into the crowd in a way that was completely unnecessary and completely unprofessional. Now, our hope is that this is going to be unusual and not the normal thing that we're going to see in the coming days.
Okay. The protesters came back in 2001 as Operation Save America, but what many locals call the Summer of Mercy 2. Not as many, no federal marshals brought in, but the city once again had the cameras and microphones of local and national media outside of George Tiller's clinic.
You don't need to go into Tiller. Please let us help. It's over again. Not killing. Officer Choi. She is over again. You are very special. Your baby is very special.
In 1970, George Tiller lost his parents, sister, and brother-in-law in a plane crash. Tiller returned to Wichita to close his father's family medicine practice here.
After I had been there for a little while, patients in the practice began to ask me if I was going to do abortions like my father did. And I was horrified, because the only thing worse than a woman that would request an abortion was the physician that would do the abortion. So I was outraged. Why would these nice people that my dad had been provided quality health care for over an extended period of time, say that he was scumbag type physician? Well, so I started going back through the charts. What chart looked like somebody might have had an abortion? So I began to ask some of these women, and I found out that there were more than one or two. Here's what happened. In 1945, 46, or 47, a young woman for whom dad had already delivered two babies came to him pregnant again right away. And she said something to the effect that, "I can't take it, can you help me?" And those are the two common denominators. That is apparently the way you ask for an abortion from your regular doctor before abortion was legal. That's my impression. That was the common denominator. "I can't take it, can you help me?" Dad said, "No, big families are in vogue. By the time the baby gets here, everything will be all right." She went out, had a non-health care provider abortion, came back 10 days to 2 weeks later, and died. Now, I have had the unique experience of delivering two and three babies for Tiller Family Practice patients. I know what that neat relationship is between a physician and the woman for whom he delivers two or three babies. I've had that relationship. It's a neat relationship. Having had that relationship, I can understand how upset my father was. I do not know whether he did 100 abortions or 200 abortions or 300 abortions. I think it may have been something like 200 over a period of about 20 years, but I don't know for sure. I'm a woman-educated physician. I don't know how many abortions he did, but the women in my father's practice for whom he did abortions educated me and taught me that abortion is not about babies, it's not about families. Abortion is about women's hopes, dreams, potential. The rest of their lives, abortion is a matter of survival for women.
But abortion is never seen that way for many people. It's black and white, right or wrong. Some passionately believe that each pregnancy is a life period. And even though Dr. Tiller did not do the so-called partial birth abortions, he did do abortions in the late term. He would dilate the woman over a period of days and inject the fetus heart to stop it, and then he would deliver a stillborn. This brought him patients and attention. And George Tiller was not one to fly from attention. He believed that attitude is everything, and he knew he was at great risk.
Dr. Tiller was very sensitive to this. He was a good man. He did a job that he was adamant that he was not going to let anybody bully him. It cost him his life.
Did he know that?
He knew. He knew that it could happen.
Driver, step out of the vehicle and face away from me. Move slowly. Driver, stop. Where's the gun?
Scott Roeder was arrested on I-35 on his way back to the Kansas City area where he lived. At his trial, he took the stand in his own defense, but his defense was not one of innocence of the murder at all.
Why did you kill him?
The lives of those children were in imminent danger. If someone did not stop George Tiller, he was going to continue as he had done for 36 years prior to that time. If someone did not stop him, they were going to continue to die. The babies were going to continue to die. My honest belief was that if he did not stop that at that time when I had the window of opportunity, they would have continued to die. 22 hours later, he had appointments scheduled. That's what he did for a living. There was no belief to understand that he was going to change his mind and stop the next day.
When did you first see Dr. Tiller on the 31st?
After I'd sat down for a minute or two, he had come in the main entrance, looked to his right and then to his left, and then he went back out of the main entrance into the foyer area.
What did you do?
I got up at that moment and followed him out and into the foyer area and I did what I thought was needed to be done to protect the children. I shot him.
Scott Roeder was convicted of first-degree murder and two counts of aggravated assault, one for threatening usher Gary Heppner with his gun and another for doing the same thing to another usher who chased him in the parking lot. He was sentenced to life and given an enhanced sentence of 50 years. His appeal of the hard 50 sentence awaits the Kansas Supreme Court decision. I contacted Roeder for this program, and he sent a letter to me, which in part reads... And thank you for doing this documentary on the anniversary of the stopping of George Tiller. It's my prayer that the attention you bring to abortion will shed much needed light and truth on the suffering and death the unborn experience every day. May this scourge against our society end before full judgment comes to this nation for its allowing the spilling of the thousands of innocents' blood each and every day. In the name of our great Savior, Yahshua. Scott Roeder. Dr. Tiller's clinic was closed. Late-term abortions were banned in Kansas. Last April, a new clinic, South Wind Women's Center, opened at the Kellogg address. It provides abortion services up to 21.6 weeks of pregnancy. Across a cedar fence is a pro-life clinic called Choices. It offers alternatives for women who find themselves in crisis pregnancy, all for free. Between the two driveways are sidewalk counselors who display anti-abortion pictures and approach each car with literature, advice, and offers of financial help to not have an abortion.
And psychological help. If you feel like your life's on the wrong track, we have people that will stay with you and help you make better decisions. If you feel like adoption is for you, we can help you up.
For KMUW News, I'm Eileen LeBlanc. Welcome back to the live portion of our program. Good evening. I'm Eileen LeBlanc, the news director here at KMUW. And I'm live in the studio with our very special guests, Julie Burkhart, who is the executive director of South Wind Women's Center, and Dr. Scott Stringfield, who is the medical director of the Choices Medical Center and Via Christi Family Medicine Residency Program. And they work across the cedar fence from each other. And they have agreed to come into the studios and have a conversation about abortion on the history on the day of George Tiller's murder, which was in May of 2009. So welcome back to both of you. And I think I'd like to start, Julie, with a figure that you gave me when we were doing an interview for this program, that one in three women has an abortion by the time she's 45. I had never looked up those figures, and that really astounded me. Why do so many women seek abortions?
Well, women seek abortions for a variety of reasons. And I will also point out that right now we're at an all-time historical low in terms of women who are accessing abortion care. Really? Women choose abortion for a variety of reasons. They might not have enough money to take care of a child or an additional child. Maybe that woman wants to finish her education. She might not be in a stable relationship or a relationship that she sees working out for the long term. There are women who have maternal health issues, and then there are women who are pregnant with babies who have fetal abnormalities. But what it comes down to is that each and every woman in her own heart knows what is right for her. If it's right to continue the pregnancy and have a baby and parent or choose adoption, then that's what the woman should choose, what is in her heart. If it's not the right time to continue a pregnancy and have a baby, then maybe abortion is the better option for her at that time. Right now, in terms of the abortion rate in the country, there are 16.9 abortions for every 1,000 women between the ages of 15 and 44. This is compared to, if you look back at 1981, there were 29.3 abortions for every 1,000 women within that age range.
So what's the difference between those?
Well,
two
the difference is there are a few factors. One is we have better access to contraceptive care, and specifically long-acting reversible contraceptives such as Nexplanon and intrauterine devices. This helps women to better plan their families and control their fertility. Also, we have a lack of access, especially in the Midwest and the South. And so that's another reason why the numbers could be going down, because women are not able to access that care that they might otherwise choose. You know, also during the economic crash of 08, we saw a decrease in pregnancies, decrease in births, decrease in abortions. So across the board, you know, economics was coming into play because of lack of resources. And then also lastly is the stigmatization of abortion. You know, people have been pummeled over the head, I will say, for lack of a better word, by a certain faction of the anti-choice movement. And there has been a growing stigmatization of abortion care, so women are ashamed to choose that for themselves.
Scott, do you have a response about the number of abortions and how many of them are actually done? I think I read on a website that there, since Roe v. Wade, which is in 1973, I believe, there have been 50 million legal abortions in the country. That was the number that astounded me also.
Well, I'm not sure I know exactly why the number has dropped. I mean, you can speculate. Julie's covered some of those issues, I think, from her perspective. I think another thing I would add to that is I think the political debate of the during the Clinton administration, during the Bush administration, shed light on what was going on. And I think for many people that I have found, whether they're pro-life or pro-choice, they kind of had their head in the sand. And the fact that it was kind of brought to the forefront, particularly by the partial birth abortion debate mm-hmm. at the Supreme Court level, I think it forced people to emotionally deal with what was going on. And for some, maybe they were fortified in their beliefs, and for others, they were changed.
Do you think that people have dealt with it? We're hearing in the Summer of Mercy in 91 and 2001, and it's still outside of the clinics today, there's a lot of the same kind of rhetoric that we've heard before. Are people having these kinds of conversations and dealing with it, or are we still calling names and trying to decide things for each other?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think for me, you know, here I am, the family physician on the other side of the fence, and I think probably I'm a little more unknown than George Tiller was, and certainly the clinic on the other side. That's where the focus tends to be, or at least the spotlight tends to be. I think I found for myself and the clinic that I work in, Choices Medical Clinic, it's interesting. I mean, you would think we're on the other extreme, and in reality, we kind of get, I guess, rocks thrown at us from both sides. I mean, I don't mean that literally. I mean figuratively. And I think I'm confident the rhetoric continues. And it's partially because you're dealing with a lot of people who probably really don't know all that's going on. And I think as an educator, which is what I do, I look for teachable people. And teachability means you're willing to consider what you don't know and what may be different than what you believe and what you've embraced, and whether you can maybe learn things from the other side.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you can learn from Julie?
I think so. I mean, part of the reason why I'm here is an opportunity to have some dialogue. I'm really a little bit embarrassed that it's taken this long, you know? But I think I would like Julie to know that she could approach me and talk about this. Now, we're probably going to be poles apart on some things, politically, this particular issue, how you go about doing what you think is right. But I hope that we have the opportunity to see that we don't have to fear each other.
What do you think might be one part of the solution to the fact that we are having, I mean, even though the numbers may be dropping, 1 in 3 women having an abortion? I think, Julie, you mentioned to me that everybody knows someone that's had one. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, there are a lot of people in my life that I know have had abortions or had to deal with it one way or the other, a friend or a family member. Scott, you're kind of in the business of choices to prevent abortions.
Mm-hmm.
How successful do you think you are, and what do you think are some of the answers for choosing the Choices Clinic rather than Julie's?
Yeah. Well, I think it's probably opportunity somewhat. And there are some women who don't come into our doors, and there are many who do. I think our statistics at our clinic have been that we're probably sitting around a 91% to 92% of women who, if they come into our doors, they tend not to choose abortion. Now, some of those weren't planning abortion in the first place. Some were. I think some just find themselves in a crisis. And as I heard a long time ago by someone who was pro-choice, is that a woman seeking an abortion is somewhat like a woman caught in a trap, a steel trap, and they'd be willing to chew their leg off to get out of it. I mean, they're in a desperate situation. And I think for us, and how we approach women in this situation is, one, we approach with a heart first. I mean, we want to, or I should say I specifically as a physician, I want to step between them and their crisis and give them a chance to think about it, to give them the options that I think are there. And they may indeed choose to go ahead and leave and go have an abortion. And we're not going to lock them in. We're going to try to deal with them compassionately. We're going to try to provide the services that we can. And many times it just helps to have a physician who can sit and talk to you. And that's what I'm going to try to do. And that's what I'm going to try to get my staff to do.
Julie, what happens at your clinic when a woman comes in? Does your staff give them counseling? Do you ask any questions? Are you involved in family planning and contraception?
Yeah, so I think there's a common misperception that has been perpetuated regarding abortion clinics, places that do abortion care, that somehow we're cold, we don't ask women what they want, and we're not there to give them emotional support. So we provide abortion care as well as other GYN services. We want to ensure that when each and every woman walks through that door, she is able to make the decision that's best for her and fits her life the best. So we have women who do come in for abortion services. We have women who come in for options counseling and decide that they would like to go ahead and parent. We've had women come in who are pregnant who have chosen to go through with adoption. So if you're a woman coming in for an abortion, we ask that you sit with one of our counselors to talk about the procedure, to make sure that emotionally you're in the right place. You're making this decision mm-hmm. because you yourself want this. We don't go into this lightly. We go into this with women, helping them to make the best decision available at the time for themselves. Life is not always black and white, and there is that icky gray area that sometimes we all have to live in, and we work with women to make sure that they're making the best decision possible for themselves at that time.
We did get a, and I wanted to remind people that if you have a question for us, you can email it at special@kmuw.org. You're listening to a special program on KMUW called Crossing the Cedar Fence, a discussion about the abortion issue. With my guests are Julie Burkhart, she's the executive director of the Southwind Women's Center, and Dr. Scott Stringfield, who is the medical director of Choices Medical Clinic. They're across the fence from each other, and they've decided to come in here tonight and discuss the issues with us. We did get a few email questions already, and there's one that asks, Julie, how do you and your staff have the courage to provide abortion services? And I'm sure that they're referring to the fact that there has been violence at your building, and I believe that you have had threats to your own safety. And so she's asking, how do you have the courage to go on with that? You've told me you love what you do. Why do you take the risks, and why do you have the courage?
I do. I love what I do. I guess I don't look at it as courage. It's the right thing to be doing. There are women in this community and in this region who at times will choose to have abortion care. We want to be there judgment-free so that women can access that decision if needed. So, and I don't, but, if you look at the United States, from North Dakota – all the way down to Texas and then to the southeast, we see fewer and fewer clinics that provide abortion care. These are also places that have typically high teen pregnancy rates, high childhood poverty rates, a lack of OBGYNs in general per, you know, OBGYNs per female population. Mm-hmm. So it's important that even in this part of the country, where typically we see more restrictive laws, that we have facilities available to women. So I don't feel courageous in any way. I just feel that, you know, this is where I come from, and sometimes women need some help, and we're here to do that for them.
Did you immediately have clients when you opened the clinic? Because there were not abortion services available in this area after Dr. Tiller's clinic was closed. Is that correct?
Yes, we had clients right away. And actually, our first patient was a woman coming in for options counseling.
Okay. So, Scott, I asked Julie what happens when a woman goes into the Southwind Women's Center. What happens when someone comes into your clinic? What sort of services and options are you offering?
Well, when a woman comes in the door at Choices Clinic, she's met by one of our volunteer counselors, a receptionist, and they try to get an idea of why they're there. And some women come for a pregnancy test, some because they would like an ultrasound done, some because they are seeking abortion and they want to discuss it, some are just finding themselves in a really difficult situation, like I said, between the rock and the hard place. Mm-hmm. And so one of our volunteer team or one of our RNs that are there is going to sit down and talk with them and kind of figure out where they're at. And one of the things that I think Julie mentioned earlier was talking about giving them their options. And I think that's something that is a foundation for medical care. And as we put together the Choices Clinic, we realized that the key foundation for us was informed consent. I mean, that's the same thing your physician's going to give you for anything you do, hopefully. You know, if you're going to come see me for surgery, I'm going to hopefully give you the risks and the benefits. I'm going to talk about what your options are and then try to help you make a decision. So we do try to, one of the key important things is to try to get good informed consent about where they are in their pregnancy, what's going on, what their options are, what are the likely possibilities. I think then we try to identify what is their true need and then try to help them. And we utilize the ultrasound, high-level ultrasound, to help them see their pregnancy, help them bond with their pregnancy, and then as we're doing that, to try to see how we can help them. I think a lot of it is, you know, our services are free. They're not without cost. It's underwritten mm-hmm. by a lot of people, but we want to make sure that that doesn't become the barrier for them to consider coming to see us.
We just got an email question from Frank Smith that asks if you provide contraceptive services at Choices and what sorts of services you provide to women who want to avoid an unintended pregnancy.
Well, we don't provide contraceptive services. We do provide health care. And if a woman, let's say who is pregnant, who is considering her options and she decides to carry her pregnancy, then we're going to try to get her in with a physician or one of many physicians who have volunteered to help with our patients. We're going to try to, if she's dealing with, for example, if she has a lethal fetal anomaly, which Julie mentioned earlier, you know, some people have a pregnancy that's in a bad situation. We're going to try to deal with that through perinatal hospice, which is counseling services and support services through that pregnancy. If they have health issues that are truly medical issues, then I'm going to become more involved. And a lot of times those patients are geared more towards the clinic day that I'm there. But if we need emergent care health-wise, we usually get them into the hospital or into the clinics that I'm affiliated with to help them with that. As far as birth control services, if that's what they're after, we don't really provide that there. It's not really the design of the clinic. We try to get them in with other physicians who can provide that if that's something they're after.
Mm-hmm. So you would never refer a patient over the fence to Julie's clinic, and you would not encourage birth control?
No. I don't want
abstinence.
You to put words in my mouth.
Sorry.
It's not an issue of birth control. I would not refer for abortion. You know, I'm pro-life. I believe from a moral perspective, from a scientific perspective as a physician. And I also am a religious man, and I believe from that perspective as well. I don't think abortion is the best option. And so I would never refer for an abortion. I don't know that I would need to. I think for the most part, women know where they can go, obviously, right across the fence. As far as birth control, if that is indeed a need they have from a healthcare standpoint, that's a totally different issue for me, at least, as I see it. Now, it depends on how you define birth control. If you define birth control as the prevention of further pregnancies, then yeah, I think those services are available throughout the clinic, I'm sorry, throughout the community by many, many providers. And that's something that they can seek, or we can kind of help them get to where they need to go.
I have another.
Eileen, could I?
Sure.
Could I respond
Please
to
do.
A couple of things that were said here? You know, I know Scott mentioned free services, and, you know, I think that's fantastic. We also make every effort, and so far we've been able to stand by this, provide medical care for each and every woman who comes through our doors, regardless of ability to pay, regardless of insurance coverage. So I think those things are great. However, I think that as a society, as a community, we would be doing a lot better if we could really take a good, hard, long look at the policies that are going to help better women's lives. That's like being able to get paid maternity leave so that you have time to be at home with a newborn. That's having housing that's affordable for yourself and your children. You know, being able to have quality childcare available for your children. You know, then also businesses, if businesses had policies so that women could come in and breastfeed. So I think that, you know, services that are free or low cost are great and needed. But as a society, we really need to be looking at these other things that really influence the lives of women and their families. I also wanted to point out that when women come in for abortion services at our clinic, they leave with a plan for their fertility, to manage mm-hmm. their fertility. And so we make sure that each and every woman has been able to choose in consultation with the doctor a contraception that's contraceptive that's going to work best for her. And I also wanted to address the issue and the need of contraceptives in the state. In the state of Kansas, about 178,000 women need publicly funded contraceptive care. Only 50,000 of those women have been able to access that. So if we had a state that provided more funding for contraceptive care, that would help to lower the unintended pregnancy rate, thus abortion rate.
Well, let's talk about the economics of it, because I think that when you're talking about people that make less money and are not able to have insurance and not able to afford abortions, not able to afford care, and if they have an unwanted pregnancy and subsequently unwanted or unplanned for children, they're going to possibly fall into public care at that point, into Medicaid, and it's going to cost the state one way or the other, isn't it? You're paying for contraception, or you're going to end up paying for the care of these children.
Well, I did want to cite a recent study by ANSWER. It's Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health, and it's their Turnaway study. And the study, it surveyed women who were too far and were unable to access abortion services. So 80% of those women who went to term decided to keep their children, and they were parenting. 11% gave their children up for adoption. What was found out of the 86% is that those women were more likely to be living in a state of poverty. And, you know, that can be very profound for the lives of those women.
Scott, what do you think?
Well, a couple things I'm thinking about. You know, I want to make sure that we define contraceptive correctly. When I was at the Orpheum Theater with the panel, the issue of contraceptive care came up that an audience member asked me, and they said, you know, what do you think about the fact that women don't have access to contraceptive care? And I said, well, you know, I work in a residency program, and we deal with an indigent population, and I'm not seeing that as an issue in my experience in 20 years, that women are really having a hard time accessing contraceptive care as I understand it, birth control and the like. What I was corrected on by someone later, they said, well, no, they have a hard time finding an abortion. And I think it depends on how you define contraceptive. And if you define contraceptive as the prevention of another pregnancy, then I think, in my experience, at least with the indigent population that I have served, it's not been an issue. Now, there may be those who are not technically qualified that way, that they have a hard time providing or getting that service provided to them. I guess that's how I'd look at that. It's interesting, earlier you asked kind of, Julie had an opportunity to kind of talk about how she was seen. And I think mm-hmm. it's important that, if you don't mind, I'd like to weigh in on that just a second, because I think sometimes, you know, what I have found is that people think the pro-life and the pro-choice issue is an either-or. In other words, you're one or you're the other.
Mm-hmm.
And in my experience for the last 19 years involved in this, is I've come to the conclusion that it's a continuum, and you and I have talked about this before. And people come somewhere down on that line depending upon their background, their baggage, their experience, their emotions, who's influenced them, what they've read, and the like. And it's interesting. I think sometimes the pro-life caricature that is portrayed by some is not valid, obviously. And you and I talked earlier about labels, and I think that's one of those things. You know, Julie had a chance to kind of talk about what they're not, even though sometimes they're perceived that way. I think sometimes people perceive the pro-life perspective is that we're harsh, we're uncaring, lawless, a fringe element, unintelligent, focused only on the baby and not the mom. And the other thing is that people tend to think we're all alike,
mm-hmm.
which is an interesting thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes it takes people to have their emotions reached before they're going to consider the possibility of being teachable and listen and consider that there's some people out there that might be different than them, and what can I learn from them? So I think that's, you know, kind of overall, as I look at this perspective, it's interesting. And my job, as I see it as a physician, is to influence people towards a more pro-life perspective through the way that I care for them.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the labels and pro-life and pro-choice. I don't think that you like the term pro-choice, Julie. Is that right?
No, I don't care for the term choice because, you know, I think that some women don't have a choice because of their life circumstances. So what we do is we help women with their decision-making process, and they're able then to decide what is best for them.
Do you feel that there is baggage out there, that there is black and white, that you're this or you're not, you're one side or you're the other, there is no gray area? It seems like a lot of the people that I talked to, especially for doing the documentary, that there was a but in most people's feelings as to how they believe. I am pro-life, but I don't understand other people's situations.
It's interesting. The patients that come to see us, and I don't know if that's the same experience that Julie has, but it's often the most common response I hear is, I'm pro-life, but.
Really?
And afterwards is the dot, dot, dot of their experience and where they're at. So in other words, they are pragmatic about it, I guess is the way I would term it. They would normally be pro-life, but in their situation and what they see as their crisis, they are considering the option of abortion. And so they have an opportunity to talk to that. But that was an amazing thing for me to see, that that's the most common response that we see. And so I guess mm-hmm. the way I look at it, I don't really need to know where they're coming from. I just know that they're in a situation that they don't want to be in. And how can I address that? But what I found is they probably haven't had a chance to really formulate their thoughts of where they really are and be principled in that, and that they're going to do what they believe in. And so I find that that's common, really common. Because I think a lot of people haven't really thought through where they're at. I think when they hear the issue pro-life, pro-choice, they turn off their ears. They turn off their mind. They turn off their heart. They don't want to talk about it. They say mm-hmm. it's an unwinnable argument. No one's going to find any common ground. And in reality, there is, as you get more into the situation, consider the individual stories of the people, think about the people on the other side of the cedar fence, you might have a chance to actually grow, learn, and change.
You think so?
Yeah, I do.
I think that having this discussion is a step certainly to understanding. I'm not sure it's a step to changing anyone's mind, whether or how they believe.
Well, it depends. I'm sorry, Julie. It depends on who you're dealing with. I mean, there are people who, you know, people come to me and they say, let's talk about it. Let's have a debate or let's discuss this. And my first question to them is, do you really want to have a discussion? Or if I convince you, whatever that position is, to come to my side, are you going to change? And oftentimes it's no. Mm-hmm. And then I'll say to them, well, why are we having this discussion? You know, it's just like wrestling with a pig, you know? We're both going to get dirty, but the pig's going to like it. And so I want to make sure that I'm going to have a discussion with someone who's teachable, willing to consider where I'm coming from. That's the main reason why I came to this. Julie, I want to let you answer. I cut you off. I apologize.
Well, you know, there's a big ideological divide when it comes to abortion care, and it's been greatly politicized. When you look at the birth control, we're now down to the point in this country where we're actually debating the merits of birth control. 90% of all American women have at one time used a form of contraception. And this is part of that ideological divide. And so what I find is that if you do not line up with the way in which the anti-choice folks think and their doctrine, then you're something other than. And you are ostracized and demonized, and there's no room for that dialogue. And so it makes it very hard to communicate. And, you know, frankly, at the clinic, I really, really long for the day when I can go into my office and not see white crosses out in the lawn and not see a table set up picnic style with my face on it.
Your face on it?
Yes, it's on the banner. Oh. And without people with notebooks noting when I or other staff members come and go, when patients come and go, when our vendors come and go, you know, this is harassment and stalking, and they want us to line up with their strict ideology, and there's no room for any other. And that goes back to the gray area that we have in life. We've all got to make difficult decisions sometimes. We all live in that gray area sometimes, and we're just helping women to make the best decision possible for themselves and their families at that moment in time.
How representative are those people that are outside the clinic? When I went to interview Julie the first time, they took my picture because I had an out-of-state license plate. But, Scott, they're not part of the Choices Clinic, are they?
No, I mean, I think the people who gather on the sidewalk outside Julie's clinic are just people who feel they need to. There may be some loose organizations, but they're not affiliated with us. It's not that I guess I would say it's unfortunate what occurs. But what I've known is I'm a physician. I can step into this arena based on my training and really try to contribute. There are probably some people who don't have that skill set or training, and they're, I think, out of desperation sometimes trying to do something, driven by emotion. I would jump in and say, though, that part of what allows for dialogue is the careful use of semantics, grammar, choice, language. And, you know, our clinic is named Choices Clinic for a reason. We want women to consider all their choices. And I'd have to say, Julia, I would hope that, I think when you use the term anti-choice, it is a negative. And, you know, I would just look at it and say, you know, I'm on the other side of the fence. I'm trying to offer a caring option for women. And even though we may disagree about, you know, where that ends up or where that should go, I'd want to be careful about the language that I use, because I would just consider it and say, you know, they're promoting an option of abortion. We are promoting an option of not aborting. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I would look at it. Rather than me being anti-choice, I'm actually pro-choice in a lot of ways. In other words, I want people to have choice. You know, this country is founded on freedom. I want them to have the choice to do that. And if they legally have the option to do things, then, you know, they're going to choose that if they want to. But I think I want to make sure that they understand and have that informed consent.
Julie, you mentioned earlier that abortion wasn't really, that the laws weren't really about abortion, that it's a political wedge issue. And I believe that also you mentioned to me earlier that the laws that are in place now in the state of Kansas are not necessarily aligned with the population. Tell me what you believe the population to think and how that is or is not in line with the political atmosphere.
Well, in all the polling that I had previously done, time and again, we saw that people want to have options and believe that abortion is sometimes necessary. So in this state, which is often considered to be a very conservative state, time and time again, we have seen that women are, that the electorate is supportive of women's reproductive rights. So we look at a legislature that does not, I mean, and now the divide is even deeper. We see a legislature that does not reflect the philosophy that the electorate holds, a majority of them. And so this is damaging to women, women's lives, when women are not able to readily access reproductive health care services when and if they need them.
We're going to be running out of time here in just a minute. I wanted to give you each a chance to say a final few words on what we've talked about tonight or the situation. Julie?
Well, let's see.
Did we do okay? should we be proud of ourselves?
I certainly did not cover everything that I was hoping to cover.
Well, maybe this is the beginning of the conversation and not the end.
Well, there are some, once again, I wanted to be here tonight because I think it's important for us to honor where women are at in their lives and the decisions that they make for themselves and their families. I think it would behoove us as a community and a society to focus more on outcomes that pregnant women have, and this is from abortion care to birth. And I think also focusing on contraceptive care and making it more widely available to women, and also medically accurate sex education so people can make informed decisions about their lives and their bodies.
And Scott, very quickly.
I guess I would say it was fun.
that is
thanks,
correct.
Eileen. Thanks, Julie. I think my goal wasn't to come here and convince Julie to come across the cedar fence, although that would be nice. I think the opportunity was just for Julie to see me as who I am and for me to see who she was, and that we have perspectives and ideas. And I appreciate the fact that you've given us this chance to kind of take the first step.
And I think it is the first step, and I hope that maybe you'll come back and talk with us again.
We'd love to.
And we'd like for anyone who has a comment to go ahead and send us an email at special@kmuw.org. You can also go to our website, kmuw.org, and we have a lot of archival footage there from the Summer of Mercy protests and various people we've interviewed and quotes from them. And take a look at it. Let us know what you think. You're listening to KMUW 91.9, and we thank you very much for tuning in this evening.